For the next 9 years, these tests were repeated. The conclusions stated the following. Among well-functioning older adults, DM, diabetes mellitus, and poor glucose control among those with DM are associated with worse cognitive function and greater decline. This suggests that severity of DM may contribute to accelerated cognitive aging. The researchers demonstrated a fairly dramatic difference in the rate of mental decline among those with diabetes as compared to the non-diabetics. More interesting still, they also noted that even at the start of the study, baseline cognitive scores of the diabetics were already lower than the controls. The study also found a direct relationship between the rate of cognitive decline and higher levels of hemoglobin A1c, a marker of blood glucose control. The authors stated, hyperglycemia, elevated blood sugar, has been proposed as a mechanism that may contribute to the association between diabetes and reduced cognitive function. They went on to state that hyperglycemia may contribute to cognitive impairment through such mechanisms as the formation of advanced glycation end products, inflammation, and microvascular disease. Before I get to explaining what advanced glycation end products are and how they are formed, let's turn to one more study done earlier in 2008. This one, from the Mayo Clinic and published in the Archives of Neurology, looked at the effects of the duration of diabetes. In other words, does how long one has diabetes play into the severity of cognitive decline? You bet. The numbers are eye-popping. According to the Mayo's findings, if diabetes began before a person was 65 years old, the risk for mild cognitive impairment was increased by a whopping 220%. And the risk of mild cognitive impairment in individuals who had diabetes for 10 years or longer was increased by 176%. If people were taking insulin, their risk was increased by 200%. The authors described a proposed mechanism to explain the connection between persistent high blood sugar and Alzheimer's disease. Increased production of advanced glycation end products. Just what are these glycation end products cropping up in the medical literature in reference to cognitive decline and accelerated aging? I mentioned them briefly in the previous chapter, and I will explain their significance in the next section. One mad cow and many clues to neurological disorders. I remember the hysteria that swept the globe in the mid-1990s when fears of mad cow disease spread quickly, as people in Britain began to document evidence of transmission of the disease from cattle to humans. In the summer of 1996, Peter Hall, a 20-year-old vegetarian, died of the human form of mad cow, called variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. He'd contracted it from eating beef burgers as a child. Soon thereafter, other cases were confirmed, and countries, including the United States, started banning beef imports from Britain. Even McDonald's stopped serving burgers momentarily in some areas until scientists could ferret out the origins of the outbreak and measures were taken to eradicate the problem. Mad cow disease, also called bovine spongiform encephalopathy, is a rare bovine disorder that infects cattle. The nickname comes from the odd behaviors sick cows express when infected. Both forms are types of prion diseases, which are caused by deviant proteins that inflict damage as they spread aggressively from cell to cell. While mad cow disease isn't usually classified with classic neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Lou Gehrig's disease, all the conditions have a similar deformation in the structure of proteins needed for normal, healthy functioning. Granted, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Lou Gehrig's disease are not transmissible to people like mad cow, but they nevertheless result in similar features that scientists are just beginning to understand. And it all boils down to deformed proteins. Much in the way we now know that dozens of degenerative diseases are linked by inflammation, we also know that dozens of those same diseases, including type 2 diabetes, cataracts, atherosclerosis, emphysema, and dementia are linked to deformed proteins. What makes prion diseases so unique is the ability of those abnormal proteins to confiscate the health of other cells, turning normal cells into misfits that lead to brain damage and dementia. It's similar to cancer in that one cell hijacks the normal regulation of another cell and creates a new tribe of cells that don't act like healthy ones. Working in laboratories with mice, scientists are finally collecting evidence to show that major neurodegenerative conditions follow parallel patterns. Proteins are among the most important structures in the body. They practically form and shape the entire body itself, carrying out functions and acting like master switches to our operating manual. Our genetic material, or DNA, codes for our proteins, which are then produced as a string of amino acids. They need to achieve a three-dimensional shape to carry out their tasks, such as regulating the body's processes and guarding against infection. Proteins gain their shape through a special folding technique. In the end, each protein achieves a distinctive shape that helps determine its unique function. Obviously, deformed proteins cannot serve their function well, or at all, and unfortunately, deformed proteins cannot be fixed. If they fail to fold properly into their correct shape, at best they are inactive, and at worst, toxic. Usually, cells have built-in technology to extinguish deformed proteins, but aging and other factors can interfere with this process. When a toxic protein is capable of inducing other cells to create misfolded proteins, the result can be disastrous. Which is why the goal for many scientists today is to find a way to stop the cell-to-cell spread of misshapen proteins and literally halt these diseases in their tracks. Stanley Prusiner, the director of the Institute for Neurodegenerative Diseases at the University of California, San Francisco, discovered prions, which earned him the Nobel Prize in 1997. In 2012, he was part of a team of researchers who authored a landmark paper presented in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that showed that amyloid beta protein associated with Alzheimer's shares prion-like characteristics. In their experiment, they were able to follow the progression of disease by injecting amyloid beta protein into one side of mice's brains and observing its effects. Using a light-generating molecule, they could see the marauding proteins collect as the mice's brains lit up, a toxic chain of events that's similar to what happens in the Alzheimer's brain. This discovery holds clues to more than brain disease. Scientists who focus on other areas of the body also have been looking at the impact of shape-shifting proteins. In fact, MAD proteins may play a role in a range of diseases. Type 2 diabetes, for example, can be seen from this perspective when we consider the fact that people with diabetes have demented proteins in their pancreas that can negatively affect insulin production, which begs the question, does chronic high blood sugar cause the deformation? In atherosclerosis, the cholesterol buildup typical of the disease could be caused by protein misfolding. People with cataracts have rogue proteins that collect in the eye lens. Cystic fibrosis, a hereditary disorder caused by a defect on the DNA, is characterized by improper folding of the CFTR protein. And even a type of emphysema owes its devastation to abnormal proteins that build up in the liver and never reach the lungs. Okay. So now that we've established that wayward proteins play a role in disease and especially neurological degeneration, the next question is, what causes the proteins to misfold? With a condition like cystic fibrosis, the answer is more clear-cut because we have identified a specific genetic defect. But what about other ailments that have mysterious origins or that don't manifest until later in life? Let's turn to those glycation end products. Glycation is the biochemical term for the bonding of sugar molecules to proteins, fats, and amino acids. The spontaneous reaction that causes the sugar molecule to attach itself is sometimes referred to as the Maillard reaction. Louis-Camille Maillard first described this process in the early 1900s. Although he predicted that this reaction could have an important impact on medicine, not until 1980 did medical scientists turn to it when trying to understand diabetic complications and aging. This process forms advanced glycation end products, commonly shortened appropriately to AGEs, which cause protein fibers to become misshapen and inflexible. To get a glimpse of AGEs in action, simply look at someone who is prematurely aging, someone with a lot of wrinkles, sagginess, discolored skin, and a loss of radiance for their age. What you're seeing is the physical effect of proteins hooking up with renegade sugars, which explains why AGEs are now considered key players in skin aging. Or, check out a chain smoker. The yellowing of the skin is another hallmark of glycation. Smokers have fewer antioxidants in their skin, and the smoking itself increases oxidation in their bodies and skin. So they cannot combat the byproducts of normal processes like glycation, because their body's antioxidant potential is severely weakened, and frankly, overpowered by the volume of oxidation. For most of us, the external signs of glycation show up in our 30s, when we've accumulated enough hormonal changes and environmental oxidative stress, including sun damage. Glycation is an inevitable fact of life, just like inflammation and free radical production to some degree. It's a product of our normal metabolism and fundamental in the aging process. We can even measure glycation using technology that illuminates the bonds formed between sugars and proteins. In fact, dermatologists are well-versed in this process. With Vizia complexion analysis cameras, they can capture the difference between youth and age just by taking a fluorescent image of children and comparing it to the faces of older adults. The children's faces will come out very dark, indicating a lack of AGEs, whereas the adults will beam brightly as all those glycation bonds light up. Clearly, the goal is to limit or slow down the glycation process. Many anti-aging schemes are now focused on how to reduce glycation and even break those toxic bonds. But this cannot happen when we consume a high-carb diet, which speeds up the glycation process. Sugars in particular are rapid stimulators of glycation, as they easily attach themselves to proteins in the body. And here's a good bit of trivia. The number one source of dietary calories in America comes from high fructose corn syrup, which increases the rate of glycation by a factor of 10. When proteins become glycated, at least two important things happen. First, they become much less functional. Second, once proteins become bonded to sugar, they tend to attach themselves to other similarly damaged proteins and form cross-linkages that further inhibit their ability to function. But perhaps far more important is that once a protein is glycated, it becomes the source of a dramatic increase in the production of free radicals. This leads to the destruction of tissues, damaging fat, other proteins, and even DNA. Again, glycation of proteins is a normal part of our metabolism, but when it's excessive, many problems arise. High levels of glycation have been associated with not only cognitive decline, but also kidney disease, diabetes, vascular disease, and, as mentioned, the actual process of aging itself. Keep in mind that any protein in the body is subject to being damaged by glycation and can become an AGE. Because of the significance of this process, medical researchers around the world are hard at work trying to develop various pharmaceutical ways to reduce AGE formation. But clearly, the best way to keep AGEs from forming is to reduce the availability of sugar in the first place. Beyond just causing inflammation and free radical-mediated damage, AGEs are associated with damage to blood vessels and are thought to explain the connection between diabetes and vascular issues. As I noted in the previous chapter, the risk of coronary artery disease is dramatically increased in diabetics, as is the risk of stroke. Many individuals with diabetes have significant damage to the blood vessels supplying the brain, and while they may not have Alzheimer's, they may suffer from dementia caused by this blood supply issue. Earlier, I explained that LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, is an important carrier protein bringing vital cholesterol to brain cells. Only when it becomes oxidized does it wreak havoc on blood vessels. And we now understand that when LDL becomes glycated, it's a protein after all, this dramatically increases its oxidation. The link between oxidative stress and sugar cannot be overstated. When proteins are glycated, the amount of free radicals formed is increased 50-fold. This leads to loss of cellular function and eventually cell death. This calls our attention to the powerful relationship between free radical production, oxidative stress, and cognitive decline. We know that oxidative stress is directly related to brain degeneration. Studies show that damage to lipids, proteins, DNA, and RNA by free radicals happens early in the journey to cognitive impairment and long before signs of serious neurological disorders such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Lou Gehrig's disease. Sadly, by the time a diagnosis is made, the damage is already done. The bottom line is that if you want to reduce oxidative stress and the action of free radicals harming your brain, you have to reduce the glycation of proteins, which is to say, you have to diminish the availability of sugar, pure and simple. Most doctors employ a measurement of one glycated protein routinely in their medical practice. I've already mentioned it, hemoglobin A1C. This is the same standard laboratory measurement used to measure blood sugar control in diabetics. So while your doctor may be measuring your hemoglobin A1C from time to time to get an understanding of your blood sugar control, the fact that it's glycated protein has vast and extremely important implications for your brain health. But hemoglobin A1C represents more than just a simple measurement of average blood sugar control over a 90 to 120-day period. Hemoglobin A1C is the protein found in the red blood cell that carries oxygen and binds to blood sugar, and this binding is increased when blood sugar is elevated. While hemoglobin A1C doesn't give a moment-to-moment indication of what the blood sugar is, it is extremely useful in that it shows what the average blood sugar has been over the previous 90 days. This is why hemoglobin A1C is frequently used in studies that try to correlate blood sugar control to various disease processes like Alzheimer's, mild cognitive impairment, and coronary artery disease. It's well documented that glycated hemoglobin is a powerful risk factor for diabetes, but it's also been correlated with risk for stroke, coronary heart disease, and death from other illnesses. These correlations have been shown to be strongest with any measurement of hemoglobin A1C above 6.0%. We now have evidence to show that elevated hemoglobin A1C is associated with changes in brain size. In one particularly profound study published in the journal Neurology, researchers looking at MRIs to determine which lab test correlated best with brain atrophy found that the hemoglobin A1C demonstrated the most powerful relationship. When comparing the degree of brain tissue loss in those individuals with the lowest hemoglobin A1C, 4.4 to 5.2, to those having the highest hemoglobin A1C, 5.9 to 9.0, the brain loss in those individuals with the highest hemoglobin A1C was almost doubled during a 6-year period. So hemoglobin A1C is far more than just a marker of blood sugar balance, and it's absolutely under your control. An ideal hemoglobin A1C would be in the 5.0 to 5.5 range. Keep in mind that reducing carbohydrate ingestion, weight loss, and physical exercise will ultimately improve insulin sensitivity and lead to a reduction of hemoglobin A1C. You also should know that there's now documented evidence proving a direct relationship between hemoglobin A1C and the future risk of depression. One study looked at more than 4,000 men and women whose average age was 63 years and showed a direct correlation between hemoglobin A1C and depressive symptoms. Poor glucose metabolism was described as a risk factor for the development of depression in these adults. The bottom line, the glycation of proteins is bad news for the brain. Early action. As I've already described, having normal blood sugar levels may mean that the pancreas is working overtime to keep that blood sugar normal. Based upon this understanding, you can see that high insulin levels will happen long before blood sugar rises and a person becomes diabetic. That's why it's so important to check not only your fasting blood sugar, but also your fasting insulin level. An elevated fasting insulin level is an indicator that your pancreas is trying hard to normalize your blood sugar. It's also a clear signal that you are consuming too much carbohydrate. And make no mistake about it, even being insulin resistant is a powerful risk factor for brain degeneration and cognitive impairment. It's not good enough to look at the diabetes data as it relates to brain disease and be confident that your risk has been ameliorated because you are not diabetic. And if your blood sugar happens to be normal, the only way you will know if you are insulin resistant is to have your fasting blood insulin level checked. Period. Need more evidence? Consider a study done a few years ago that looked at 523 people aged 70 to 90 years who did not have diabetes or even elevated blood sugar. Many of them were insulin resistant, however, as determined by their fasting insulin levels. The study revealed that those individuals who were insulin resistant had a dramatically increased risk of cognitive impairment compared to those within the normal range. Overall, the lower the insulin level, the better. The average insulin level in the United States is about 8.8 micro international units per milliliter for adult men and 8.4 for women. But with the degree of obesity and carbohydrate abuse in America, it's safe to say that these average values are likely much higher than what should be considered ideal. Patients who are being very careful about their carbohydrate intake might have insulin levels indicated on their lab report as less than 2.0. This is an ideal situation, a sign that the individual's pancreas is not being overworked, blood sugars are under excellent control, there is very low risk for diabetes, and there is no evidence of insulin resistance. The important point is that if your fasting insulin level is elevated, anything over 5 should be considered elevated. It can improve. And I will tell you how to do that later in the book. The fatter you are, the smaller your brain. Most everyone has a pretty good idea that carrying around extra weight is unhealthy. But if you needed just one more reason to drop the excess pounds, perhaps the fear of losing your mind, physically and literally, will help motivate you. When I was studying to be a doctor, the prevailing wisdom was that fat cells were primarily storage bins where unwanted masses of excess could hang out silently on the sidelines. But that was a grossly misguided perspective. Today, we know that fat cells do more than simply store calories. They are far more involved in human physiology. Masses of body fat form complex, sophisticated hormonal organs that are anything but passive. You heard that right. Fat is an organ. And it could very well be one of the body's most industrious organs, serving a lot of functions beyond keeping us warm and insulated. This is especially true of visceral fat, the fat wrapped around our internal visceral organs, such as the liver, kidneys, pancreas, heart, and intestines. Visceral fat has also gotten a lot of press lately. We know now that this type of fat is the most devastating to our health. We may lament our thunder thighs, underarm curtains, love handles, cellulite, and big butts, but the worst kind of fat is the kind many of us cannot even see, feel, or touch. In extreme cases, we do see it in the bulging bellies and muffin tops that are the outward signs of fat-enveloped internal organs below decks. For this very reason, waist circumference is often a measurement of health, as it predicts future health challenges and mortality. The higher your waist circumference, the higher your risk for disease and death. It's well documented that visceral fat is uniquely capable of triggering inflammatory pathways in the body, as well as signaling molecules that disrupt the body's normal course of hormonal actions. This, in turn, keeps the cascade of negative effects from visceral fat going. In addition, visceral fat does more than just generate inflammation down the road through a chain of biological events. Visceral fat itself becomes inflamed. This kind of fat houses tribes of inflammatory white blood cells. In fact, the hormonal and inflammatory molecules produced by visceral fat get dumped directly into the liver, which, as you can imagine, responds with another round of ammunition, that is, inflammatory reactions and hormone-disrupting substances. Long story short, more than merely a predator lurking behind a tree, it is an enemy that is armed and dangerous. The number of health conditions now linked to visceral fat is tremendous, from the obvious ones such as obesity and metabolic syndrome, to the not so obvious, cancer, autoimmune disorders, and brain disease. The dots connecting excessive body fat, obesity, and brain dysfunction are not hard to follow given the information you've already learned in this book. Excessive body fat increases not only insulin resistance, but also the production of inflammatory chemicals that play directly into brain degeneration. In a 2005 study, the waist-to-hip ratios of more than 100 individuals were compared to structural changes in their brains. The study also looked at brain changes in relation to fasting blood sugar and insulin levels. What the authors wanted to determine was whether or not a relationship existed between the brain's structure and the size of a person's belly, and the results were striking. Essentially, the larger a person's waist-to-hip ratio, that is, the bigger the belly, the smaller the brain's memory center, the hippocampus. The hippocampus plays a critical role in memory, and its function is absolutely dependent upon its size. As your hippocampus shrinks, your memory declines. More striking still, the researchers found that the higher the waist-to-hip ratio, the higher the risk for small strokes in the brain, also known to be associated with declining brain function. The authors stated, "These results are consistent with a growing body of evidence that links obesity, vascular disease, and inflammation to cognitive decline and dementia." Other studies since then have confirmed the finding. For every excess pound put on the body, the brain gets a little smaller. How ironic that the bigger the body gets, the smaller the brain gets. In a joint research project between UCLA and the University of Pittsburgh, neuroscientists examined brain images of 94 people in their 70s who had participated in an earlier study of cardiovascular health and cognition. None of the participants had dementia or other cognitive impairments, and they were followed for 5 years. What these researchers found was that the brains of obese people, defined by having a body mass index above 30, looked 16 years older than their healthy counterparts of normal weight, and those who were overweight, defined by having a body mass index between 25 and 30, looked 8 years older than their leaner counterparts. More specifically, the clinically obese people had 8% less brain tissue, while the overweight had 4% less brain tissue compared to normal weight individuals. Much of the tissue was lost in the frontal and temporal lobe regions of the brain, the place from which we make decisions and store memories, among other things. The authors of the study rightfully pointed out that their findings could have serious implications for aging, overweight, or obese individuals, including a heightened risk for Alzheimer's disease. Without a doubt, vicious cycles are at play here, each of which is contributing to the other. Genetics could affect one's propensity to overeat and gain weight, and this then factors into activity levels, insulin resistance, and risk for diabetes. Diabetes then affects weight control and blood sugar balance. Once a person becomes diabetic and sedentary, it's inevitable that a breakdown in tissues and organs occurs, and not just in the brain. What's more, once the brain begins to degenerate and physically shrink, it begins to lose its ability to function properly. That is to say, the brain's appetite and weight control centers won't be firing on all cylinders and could actually be misfiring, and this again feeds the vicious cycle. It is important to understand that weight loss needs to happen right now, as changes take place as soon as an individual begins to carry excess body fat. To some degree, we can predict whose brain will suffer 30 years from now simply by measuring body fat. In a 2008 report, California scientists combed through the records of more than 6,500 people who were evaluated in the mid-1960s to 1970s. They wanted to know, who got dementia? When these folks were first evaluated an average of 36 years earlier, various measurements were made of their bodies to determine how much fat they had. These included the size of the belly, thigh circumference, and height and weight. Roughly three decades later, those individuals who had more body fat had a dramatic increased risk for dementia. Of the original group, 1,049 were diagnosed as having dementia. When the scientists compared the group with the least body fat to the group with the highest body fat, they found that those in the highest body fat group had an almost twofold increased risk of dementia. The authors reported, as is the case for diabetes and cardiovascular disease, central obesity, belly fat, is also a risk factor for dementia. The power of weight loss, besides what you already know. As study after study has proven, weight loss through dieting can have a dramatic effect on insulin signaling and insulin sensitivity. In one report, doctors evaluated 107 obese individuals at least 65 years of age over a one-year period and studied how they responded in terms of insulin to an oral dose of glucose. The researchers wanted to measure the difference among three distinct groups: those who were put on a weight loss program, those who were assigned an exercise program, and those put on a diet and exercise program. A fourth group of people was designated as a control group for purposes of further comparison. The results, 6 months later? People in the weight loss group had a 40% increase in their insulin sensitivity. This also happened in the group that went on a weight loss program and exercised. The group that didn't embark on a weight loss program but did exercise, however, showed no change in insulin sensitivity. When the study was finally concluded after 1 year, insulin sensitivity had improved by a whopping 70% in those who lost weight. People who were exercising while on a diet and lost weight had an 86% improvement in their sensitivity to insulin. But the third group, the one that engaged in physical activity without dieting and losing weight, remained far behind. Even after 1 year, they had absolutely no change in their insulin sensitivity. So the take-home lesson is clear. You can improve insulin sensitivity and reduce your risk of diabetes, not to mention all manner of brain diseases, simply by making lifestyle changes that melt that fat away. And if you add exercise to the dieting, you'll stand to gain even bigger benefits. By now, you should know that I'm going to prescribe a low-carb diet rich in healthy fats, including cholesterol. And don't take my word for it. Just turn to the latest studies proving the power of this type of diet. Last year, the Journal of the American Medical Association published the effects of three popular diets on a group of overweight or obese young adults. Each of the participants tried each of the diets for a month. One was low fat. 60% of the calories came from carbohydrate, 20% from fat, and 20% from protein. One was low glycemic. 40% of the calories came from carbohydrate, 40% from fat, and 20% from protein. And the third was a very low carbohydrate diet, 10% of the calories came from carbohydrates, 60% from fat, and 30% from protein. All of the diets provided the same number of calories, but those on the low-carb, high-fat diet burned the most calories. The study also looked at insulin sensitivity during the 4-week period on each diet, finding that the low-carb diet triggered the biggest improvement in insulin sensitivity, almost twice that of the low-fat diet. Triglycerides, a powerful cardiovascular risk marker, averaged 66 in the low-carb group and 107 in the low-fat group. As an aside, elevated triglyceride levels are also a hallmark of too many carbs in the diet. The authors also pointed out that the lab results they measured in the low-fat diet showed changes in people's blood chemistry that left them vulnerable to weight gain. Clearly, the best diet for maintaining weight loss is a low-carbohydrate, high-fat one. Many other studies have arrived at the same conclusion. A low-carb, high-fat diet will outperform a low-fat, high-carb diet any day, and by virtually every measure in the body, from its internal chemistry to its external waistline. And when we consider all of the parameters that affect health, and specifically brain health, such as weight loss, insulin sensitivity, blood sugar control, and even C-reactive protein, a low-carbohydrate diet is substantially more effective than any other diet. Those other diets will result in outcomes that heighten your risk for a multitude of brain dysfunctions, from daily nuisances like headaches to chronic migraines, anxiety disorders, ADHD, and depression. And if the thought of being as sharp as a whip until your last breath on earth isn't enough to motivate you, then consider all the benefits that your heart and virtually every organ in your body will gain by ditching a low-fat diet. In March 2013, the New England Journal of Medicine published a large landmark study showing that people age 55 to 80 who ate a Mediterranean diet were at lower risk of heart disease and stroke by as much as 30% than those on a typical low-fat diet. The results were so profound that scientists halted the study early because the low-fat diet proved too damaging for the people eating lots of commercially baked goods rather than sources of healthy fats. The Mediterranean diet is famous for being rich in olive oil, nuts, beans, fish, fruits and vegetables, and even wine with meals. Although it does allow room for grains, it's very similar to my dietary protocol. In fact, if you modify the traditional Mediterranean diet by removing all gluten-containing foods and limiting sugary fruits and non-gluten carbs, you have yourself the perfect grain-brain-free diet. An apple a day? No. An apple a day may not keep the doctor away. Now that I've held so many of your favorite foods in contempt, I can hear the uncertainty. How can the body live on fat and never get fat? It's an excellent question. I'm going to tackle that very conundrum shortly and settle any confusion about how you can live and thrive on fats. It sounds absurd to think we can live on virtually no carbs but copious amounts of fat and cholesterol in our diet, but we can, and we should if we're going to protect our genome. Despite what food marketers would have you believe, we've had a fat-based diet shaping our genome for the past 2.6 million years. Why change that? As you've already heard, when we did, we got fat. The story of reversing this trend and gaining back the lean, toned, lithe bodies we're designed to have, and a sharp brain to boot, starts with a look at the brain's fundamental properties. Chapter 5. The Gift of Neurogenesis and Controlling Master Switches. How to Change Your Genetic Destiny. The brain is a far more open system than we ever imagined, and nature has gone very far to help us perceive and take in the world around us. It has given us a brain that survives in a changing world by changing itself. Dr. Norman Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself. We are designed to be smart people our entire lives. The brain is supposed to work well until our last breath. But most of us assume, wrongly, that with age comes cognitive decline. We think it's an inevitable part of aging, much like hearing loss or wrinkles. This impression is a pernicious fallacy. The truth is that we're living a life that's not suited to what we're genetically supposed to do. Period. The diseases we see nowadays are largely brought on by our lifestyle not being in harmony with our genetic predisposition. But we can change this and return our DNA back to its original programming. Better yet, we can reprogram some of our DNA to function even more advantageously. And this isn't science fiction. How often do we hear people say things like, "I'll probably get, insert disease here, because it runs in my family"? No doubt, our genetic heritage does play a role in determining our risk for various health conditions. But what leading-edge medical research now understands is that we have the power to change our genetic destiny. One of the hottest areas of research currently gaining momentum is epigenetics, the study of particular sections of your DNA, called marks, that essentially tell your genes when and how strongly to express themselves. Like conductors of an orchestra, these epigenetic marks are the remote control not only to your health and longevity, but also to how you pass your genes on to future generations. Our day-to-day lifestyle choices have a profound effect on the activity of our genes. And this is empowering. We now know that the food choices we make, the stress we experience or avoid, the exercise we get or avoid, the quality of our sleep, and even the relationships we choose, actually choreograph to a significant degree which of our genes are active and which remain suppressed. Here's what is most compelling. We can change the expression of more than 70% of the genes that have a direct bearing on our health and longevity. This chapter explains how we can enhance the expression of our healthy genes while turning off those genes that trigger such detrimental events as inflammation and the production of free radicals. The genes involved in causing inflammation and free radical production are strongly influenced by fat and carbohydrate dietary choices, and this information will further support the recommendations made in the upcoming chapters. The story of neurogenesis. Does every cocktail you drink really kill thousands of brain cells? As it turns out, we are not stuck with the number of neurons we're born with, or even those that develop in early childhood. We can grow new neurons throughout our entire lives. We can also fortify existing brain circuits and create entirely new and elaborate connections, too, with new brain cells. I've been lucky enough to participate in this discovery that has overturned generations of conventional wisdom in neuroscience, though many people still believe otherwise. During my college years, I was given the opportunity to explore the brain using technology that was just in its infancy. It was in the early 1970s, and the Swiss had begun developing microscopes that could be used by neurosurgeons performing delicate brain procedures. While this technology was evolving and surgeons in the United States were eager to adopt this new approach to brain surgery, a problem soon became evident. While learning to actually use the operating microscope was relatively easy, the neurosurgeons found that they were becoming somewhat lost in terms of understanding the anatomy of the brain from this new microscopic perspective. I was 19 years old and just starting my junior year in college when I received a phone call from Dr. Albert Roten, chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Shands Teaching Hospital in Gainesville, Florida. Dr. Roten was leading the way for expansion of the use of the operating microscope in the United States and wanted to create the first anatomy text of the brain as seen through the microscope. He invited me to spend the following summer studying and mapping the brain, and it was from this research that we eventually published a series of research papers and book chapters that gave neurosurgeons the needed roadmap to more carefully operate on the brain. In addition to anatomy, we also had the opportunity to explore and develop other aspects of microneurosurgery, including innovative instruments and procedures. Spending so much time behind the microscope, I had become quite adept at manipulating and repairing extremely small blood vessels that, prior to the use of the microscope, would have been destroyed during brain operations, often with dire consequences. Our lab had gained international recognition for its achievements in this new and exciting field and often attracted visiting professors from around the world. And it was soon after a delegation of Spanish neurosurgeons had visited that I found myself accepting an invitation to continue my research at the prestigious Centro Ramón y Cajal in Madrid, Spain. Their microneurosurgery program was in its infancy, but their team was dedicated, and I felt honored to be assisting them in their groundwork efforts, especially those dealing with understanding the brain's blood supply. The hospital was named in honor of Dr. Santiago Ramón y Cajal, a Spanish pathologist and neuroscientist working at the turn of the 20th century, who is still regarded as the father of modern neurology. Images of him on the walls were numerous, and there was clearly a deep sense of pride among my Spanish colleagues that they could claim such an influential scientist as their own. In 1906, he won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his pioneering investigations of the microscopic structure of the brain. Today, hundreds of his handmade drawings are still used for educational purposes. During my visit to Madrid, I was compelled to learn more about Dr. Cajal and came to deeply respect his explorations of human brain anatomy and function. One of his major tenets held that brain neurons were unique compared to other cells of the body, not only because of their function, but also because they lacked the ability to regenerate. The liver, for example, perpetually regenerates by growing new liver cells, and similar regeneration of cells occurs in virtually all other tissues, including skin, blood, bone, and intestines. I admit that I was pretty well sold on this theory that brain cells do not regenerate, but I did wonder back then why it wouldn't make sense for the brain to retain the ability to regenerate, to have the ability to grow new brain neurons. After all, researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology had shown previously that neurogenesis, the growth of new brain neurons, occurred throughout the entire lifetime in rats. And so much about the human body is regeneration. It relies on continuous self-renewal to survive. For example, certain blood cells turn over every few hours. Taste receptor cells get replaced every 10 days. Skin cells turn over every month, and muscle cells take about 15 years to completely renew themselves. In the last decade, scientists have determined that the heart muscle, an organ that we long thought was fixed since birth, does in fact experience cellular turnover as well. When we're 25 years old, about 1% of our heart muscle cells are replaced every year. But by the age of 75, that rate has fallen to less than 0.5% per year. Hard to believe that we've only recently come to identify and understand this phenomenon in the body's blood-pumping machine. And now we've finally decoded the brain and discovered its self-renewing qualities. Dr. Cajal couldn't possibly have known just how malleable and plastic the brain could be given the technology he was working with. At that time, DNA hadn't been decoded yet, and there was little understanding of the impact genes could have on functionality. In his seminal 1928 book, Degeneration and Regeneration in the Nervous System, Cajal stated, "In adult centers, the nerve paths are something fixed, ended, immutable. Everything may die, nothing may be regenerated." If I could change his statement to reflect what we know today, I'd swap out the words fixed, ended, and immutable for the absolute opposite, pliable, open-ended, and alterable. I'd also say that brain cells may die, but they most certainly can be regenerated. Indeed, Cajal made great contributions to our knowledge of the brain and how neurons work, He was even ahead of his time in trying to understand the pathology of inflammation. But his belief that the brain was somehow stuck with its bill of goods is one that pervaded for most of human history, until modern science in the late 20th century proved just how flexible the brain could be. In my previous book, Power Up Your Brain, The Neuroscience of Enlightenment, Dr. Alberto Villoldo and I told the story of how science has come to understand the gift of neurogenesis in humans. Although scientists have long proven neurogenesis in various other animals, it wasn't until the 1990s that scientists began focusing exclusively on trying to demonstrate neurogenesis in humans. In 1998, the journal Nature Medicine published a report by Swedish neurologist Peter Eriksson, in which he claimed that within our brains exists a population of neural stem cells that are continually replenished and can differentiate into brain neurons. And indeed, he was right. We all experience brain stem cell therapy every minute of our lives. This has led to a new science called neuroplasticity. The revelation that neurogenesis occurs in humans throughout our lifetimes has provided neuroscientists around the world an exciting new reference point, with implications spanning virtually the entire array of brain disorders. It also instilled hope among those searching for clues to stopping, reversing, or even curing progressive brain disease. The idea of regenerating brain neurons established a new level of excitement in scientists dedicated to studying neurodegenerative disorders. It also paved the way for novel treatments, transforming people's lives who have suffered from serious brain injuries or disease. Look no further than Norman Doidge's The Brain That Changes Itself, stories of personal triumph from the frontiers of brain science, to hear of real-life tales that prove just how pliable our brains and our human potential are. If stroke victims can learn to speak again, and people born with partial brains can train their brains to rewire themselves to work as a whole, imagine the possibilities for those of us who just hope to preserve our mental faculties. The burning question: how can we grow new brain neurons? In other words, what influences neurogenesis, and what can we do to enhance this natural process? The process, as one might expect, is controlled by our DNA. Specifically, a gene located on chromosome 11 codes for the production of a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. BDNF plays a key role in creating new neurons. But beyond its role in neurogenesis, BDNF protects existing neurons, ensuring their survivability while encouraging synapse formation, the connection of one neuron to another, a process vital for thinking, learning, and higher levels of brain function. Studies have demonstrated decreased levels of BDNF in Alzheimer's patients, which, based on an understanding of how BDNF works, should not come as a surprise. What is, perhaps, more surprising is the association of BDNF with a variety of neurological conditions, including epilepsy, anorexia nervosa, depression, schizophrenia, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. We now have a firm understanding of the factors that influence our DNA to produce BDNF. And fortunately, these factors are mostly under our direct control. The gene that turns on BDNF is activated by a variety of lifestyle habits, including physical exercise, caloric restriction, following a ketogenic diet, and the addition of certain nutrients like curcumin and the omega-3 fat DHA. This is an empowering lesson because all of these factors are within our grasp, representing choices we can make to flip the switch that spurs the growth of new brain cells. Let's explore them individually. This is your new brain on exercise. I'm going to save the bulk of this conversation for Chapter 8, which explores in great depth the role of exercise in preventing cognitive decline. The science is stunning. Physical exercise is one of the most potent ways of changing your genes. Put simply, When you exercise, you literally exercise your genes. Aerobic exercise in particular not only turns on genes linked to longevity, but also targets the BDNF gene, the brain's growth hormone. More specifically, aerobic exercise has been shown to increase BDNF, reverse memory decline in elderly humans, and actually increase growth of new brain cells in the brain's memory center. Exercise isn't just for trim looks and a strong heart. Perhaps its most powerful effects are going on silently in the upstairs room where our brains reside. The emerging scientific view of human evolution and role of physical activity gives a whole new meaning to the phrase, jog your memory. A million years ago, we triumphed over long distances because we could outrun and outwalk most other animals. This ultimately helped make us the clever human beings we are today. The more we moved, the fitter our brain became. And even today, our brain's healthy functioning requires regular physical activity, despite the passage of time and ills of the aging process. Caloric restriction. Another epigenetic factor that turns on the gene for BDNF production is calorie restriction. Extensive studies have clearly demonstrated that when animals are on a reduced calorie diet, typically reduced by around 30%, their brain production of BDNF shoots up, and they show dramatic improvements in memory and other cognitive functions. But it's one thing to read experimental research studies involving rats in a controlled environment, and quite another to make recommendations to people based upon animal research. Fortunately, we finally have ample human studies demonstrating the powerful effect of reducing caloric intake on brain function, and many of these studies have been published in our most well-respected medical journals. In January 2009, for example, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science published a study in which German researchers compared two groups of elderly individuals, one that reduced their calories by 30%, and another that was allowed to eat whatever they wanted. The researchers were interested in whether changes could be measured between the two groups' memory function. At the conclusion of the 3-month study, those who were free to eat without restriction experienced a small but clearly defined decline in memory function, while memory function in the group on the reduced calorie diet actually increased, and profoundly so. Knowing that current pharmaceutical approaches to brain health are very limited, the authors concluded, "The present findings may help to develop new prevention and treatment strategies for maintaining cognitive health into old age." Further evidence supporting the role of calorie restriction in strengthening the brain and providing more resistance to degenerative disease comes from Dr. Mark P. Mattson at the National Institute on Aging, who reported, "Epidemiological data suggest that individuals with a low calorie intake may have a reduced risk of stroke and neurodegenerative disorders. There is a strong correlation between per capita food consumption and risk for Alzheimer's disease and stroke. Data from population-based case control studies showed that individuals with the lowest daily calorie intakes had the lowest risk of Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease." Mattson was referring to a population-based longitudinal prospective study of Nigerian families, in which some members moved to the United States. Many people believe that Alzheimer's disease is something you get from your DNA, but this particular study told a different story. It was shown that the incidence of Alzheimer's disease among Nigerian immigrants living in the United States was increased compared to their relatives who remained in Nigeria. Genetically, the Nigerians who moved to America were the same as their relatives who remained in Nigeria. All that changed was their environment, specifically their caloric intake. The research clearly focused on the detrimental effects that a higher caloric consumption has on brain health. If the prospect of reducing your calorie intake by 30% seems daunting, consider the following. On average, we consume 523 more calories a day than we did in 1970. Based on data from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the average American adult consumes 3,770 calories daily. Most would consider normal calorie consumption to be around 2,000 calories daily for women and 2,550 for men, with higher requirements depending on level of activity, exercise. A 30% cut of calories